This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Bette Midler's new act has been described as a romp and roll spectacular. 20 Coreens, a 13-piece band, 3 harlots, and of course the divine Miss M, all on stage 100 nights a year at the Coliseum at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. The showgirl must go on.
I confess, as the moon gets hotter, we'll be wearing even less. All the doors are bolted, you might be here till dawn. You can't stop the show, girl.
You can't stop the show, girl.
You can't stop the show, girl. When the show, girl, must go on.
When was the first time you caught Bette Midler's act? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can tell us your story on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, covering the R. Kelly trial in Chicago, but first, Bette Midler joins us from our bureau in New York, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
And in an otherwise rave review of your show in the New York Times, Charles Isherwood used a word I never thought would be associated with you, wholesome.
Oh, that's so sweet. I didn't read the review. I don't read reviews generally, but that's actually very nice. That's
after
very
all this time.
I guess everyone caught up to me finally.
Uh-huh. And when was the first time you appeared in Las Vegas?
I think the first time I ever went to Las Vegas was in the early 70s, maybe even the late 60s, like 69 or 70. I worked for Johnny Carson. I opened his show for him.
And at the time, you were a lot younger. Did people get the act?
You were younger, too.
Uh-huh.
You know what? Not exactly. But he was he stuck with me. He was a big defender. He really enjoyed me. And it was a fun time.
Vegas was a lot different then, too.
It was very, very different. It was definitely it wasn't as big, and it wasn't as – I mean, really, it's quite vast now. There's the Strip, of course, but then there's so much – it's 30 miles in every direction. And in those days, it wasn't like that. It was a relatively small town, and it was – you could know it. You could get to know it pretty well. There were a few high spots, and then the rest was – a desert.
And what was the room you played back in 70, 71, 72?
It was the Sahara. I'm not sure what the name of the room was. It might have been, it could have been something like the Congo room or something like that. I'm not really sure. But we played at the Sahara, and I really enjoyed it. I whenever I pass it, I'm like, I want to run in and see if that showroom is the same. We went to see the Follies Bergère at the Tropicana, and that is really old school Vegas, and I can recommend it that show to anyone who's interested in that style of entertainment.
And compare the room you played back 30 years ago to the room you're playing now.
Well, it's the new room is a room that Caesar's Palace built for Celine Dion, and it's a state-of-the-art theater. It has it's a fantastic house. It has it seats 4,500 people very comfortably, and there isn't a bad seat in the whole house. The sound system is state-of-the-art. The lighting system is state-of-the-art. She had a whole humidification system built under the stage. The dressing rooms are fantastic. It really is extraordinary. No one who's ever I have friends who have been in, you know, rock and roll their whole lives, and no one has ever seen a dressing room like this ever. So it's really extraordinary. The room I played with Johnny Carson in was it was old school. It had banquettes. It was like kind of a semicircle, and it had banquettes and tiers. And it was much, much smaller, and it was cozier. It was very, very cozy, and you felt, you know, immediately as though you were at home. Very sweet room.
We took the show out to Las Vegas a couple of years ago, and I had a chance to see not that theater, but the one that was built, I think, for Cirque du Soleil.
Unbelievable. Well, which one? There are 7 or 8 Cirques there.
I know. This was the water one.
That is the greatest show I ever saw in my entire life. I never thought that I would live to see a show like that. It was extraordinary, extraordinary. It was like a dream. Like I was very affected by it. And in fact, I brought my whole crew with me, and at the end, people were sobbing and standing up and screaming, because as people who put on shows, the idea that you could, that you had those resources and that you would do something so imaginative with what they had given you, it just blew us away.
The theaters are amazing. Just the state of the art with the computer guided. Well, everything is anyway. They're
yes,
amazing
it
things.
Is. It really is extraordinary, and the effects that some of the Cirque shows, especially, managed to make are so. They've never been seen before. Now, that was a big challenge for us, because I'm a human being, and I'm not an aerialist, and I'm not I'm not a contortionist, and I didn't want to have those kind of. I mean, I love those people and I admire them, but that's really not what I do. What I do is I do a lot of things. I sing, I dance, and I tell terrible jokes, and I try to do something that's very human scale. And that was a big challenge, because all the Cirque shows are gigantic, and they don't have a personality at the center of them. You know, I think actually the imagination is at the center of them, and my show is just me. So. I felt that was a big challenge, to make people fall in love with me and what I surrounded myself with. But I think we did a good job. I think it's a really pretty show. It's beautiful. We have gorgeous girls. The costumes are a delight. It's a visual feast, really. And there I am in the middle, just being the ringmaster, and it's a lot of fun.
Now let's get some callers on the line. Our guest, of course, Bette Midler, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And this is Hala. Hala with us from California.
Hello, it's Paula.
Paula, I'm sorry. our screener mistyped your name. I apologize.
Don't worry about that. Well, you had asked about some memories or our first exposures to the divine. And if I had to name, you know, one of my top 10 albums of my life, The Divine Miss M is right up there. And the memory I just wanted to share was my sister was the lead. She was always Miss M, and the other sisters would stand behind her, and we'd lip sync and be the harlots as my sister belted out the songs from The Divine Miss M. So that was a great memory, and I have of that album.
Do you still listen to it?
And the other part was the two version of Friends on that album. The funny version and the serious version. And I make a CD when we travel, and I have a few friends that I travel with to Reno, and that we hit the part when we're just coming into Reno where we always play Friends.
Oh, that's great. What a wonderful story.
And does it bring you luck?
sometimes yes and sometimes no.
Welcome to Vegas.
Just getting the four of us to get away from our jobs at the same time and be able to go away for the weekend.
Well, Paula,
very sweet.
Good luck next time.
Yes. Well, it's nice to meet you, and nice to hear the stories of what you're doing. I'll try to get down to Vegas to see you.
Terrific. Thank you.
So long. Let's see if we can get, this is Daniel. Daniel with us from Conway in Arkansas.
Yes, sir. I appreciate you putting me on. Bet, I just wanted to express my thanks for inspiring many through the years. You're my oldest sister's personal hero, and she turned out to be a great singer. And I'm a recently fired journalist who's going to go and try to pursue his musical career. And I really have always admired the way your flamboyant and boisterous attitude when performing, and it inspires a lot of people. A few years ago, I caught that movie you did on cable, The Rose, in which I believe you were portraying Janis Joplin, and you've probably been asked about this a million times. I wanted to see if maybe you could talk to the listeners a little bit about how you prepared for that, and if you could tell us if you had ever met her before.
You know, I didn't meet Janis, but I was a big fan of hers. And, you know, they came to me and asked me if I would do the Janis Joplin story. And I was such a big fan, I thought that it would be a mistake to take her as my inspiration. So, you know, we sort of reworked a whole lot of things about that script. But, I mean, ultimately everybody thought it was Janis, but in my mind it never was, because I had been on the road since about 1968, I guess. And in my travels, you know, doing shows and, you know, rock and roll shows and all sorts of shows, I kind kind of got the picture of what it was like to be a female in that environment. And so I use many of my memories from those days, and I helped out with the clothes, and I helped out with some of the staging. It remains my favorite picture because it had so much going for it. You know, it had terrific music, it had a great band, it had a wonderful, wonderful story, and really the opportunity to really chew the scenery. I mean, but in the best possible way. And so, I mean, but I had so much support on that picture. Everybody loved the script, and everybody really wanted it to succeed, and it did. You know, it really sort of sent me on my way. So it remains one of my favorite, actually my favorite of all the pictures I've done.
I've read that it cost you, though.
It might have. What happened? Tell me what I said.
You had problems with your voice after that picture.
I did have trouble with my voice, and I actually had a lot of trouble singing for that producer. It was Paul Rothschild, a guy who had worked with Jimmy Morrison, and he had also worked with Janis. He had worked with Bonnie Raitt, people like that. And he was good, but he was a very hard taskmaster, and I really literally sang till I bled. And it was hard. It was a very, very hard. It was very hard, and I never. The rough part about being in show business is a lot of times the work is so deadly, so hard that you forget. Even if it's a success, all you have with you are your memories of how hard it was and how, you know, what the struggle was, and that's a drag because sometimes there's these pieces of material or the shows or whatever are so – people love them so much, and it would be better if you could remember the great parts and not just the parts where you suffered.
Daniel, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks, Neil.
You know that voice. We're talking with Bette Midler, and she's taking your calls, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Never stop the thoroughfare, but I still got my health, so what do I care? Your face is your fortune, so some wise man spoke. My face is my fortune, that's why I'm totally broke. My ship ain't coming, but I grin while I bear. Cause I've got my vitamins, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H. I still have my.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In 1970, the legendary Johnny Carson retired, and one of his last guests was Bette Midler.
Johnny, what are you going to do with all that free time? I mean, Wimbledon only comes. It's only 1 week a year. And did you ever really stop to consider what would become
of Ed?
Not to mention Doc.
And the band?
Well, maybe I'm just being selfish, because after all, my life is going to change the most. I mean, how am I going to get by without you?
You sexy thing.
Your charm, your wit, your talent, your civility, and all your fabulous, fabulous guests. How I miss the social intercourse so very. Now I have to have it with the guy I marry. Still, no, I'd rather watch you.
Bette Midler with Johnny Carson in 1992. She's with us today. She may not win an Emmy for this appearance, though. If you'd like to speak with her, our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And Paul's with us. Paul calling from Grand Bank in Michigan.
Hello, Neil. Thanks for taking my call. Ms. Midler, it's a thrill to hear you. I'd like to go back a little bit further, many years ago, more than we both like to admit, I guess, when I was watching
TV. But I look fabulous.
I still look great. I was watching TV late at night, and I said, well, let's check out The Tonight Show. And I clicked over, and Johnny said something about, we're going to bring out this singer. Everything about her is 30-ish. And you came out, and you sang your 30s songs, and you had that long dress on. You had long, dark hair. And then you sat down, and you gave just as good as you got. You went toe-to-toe with Johnny Carson, It was just a wonderful show. You made a remark about your manager getting you a great room at the Y, I think. But that pales in comparison to what I just listened in. And when I watched you on the last appearance of Johnny on the Tonight Show, and the most sincere and loving thankful that you thank you that you sang to him, you are at the top of my list for class act. I've never seen anything like it, and I just wanted to let you know that.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
That appearance.
It's lovely.
It's lovely. That appearance on Carson, that last one, got you not only the Emmy, I think that put you in a new place, I think, in a lot of people's minds.
You know, I think perhaps you're right. I remember being kind of stunned that I wound up to be the one who was the last one. And it was something that I couldn't really think about too much because it would have been so frightening. But I adored him, and he was so supportive. I mean, even in the earliest, darkest days of my career, I mean, he saw what I could have become, and he sort of brought me along until I became what it was that he imagined I could be. And so I, of course, was very happy to be, to repay that debt, and I'm very touched by. I was very touched by the outpouring of, really love that I received after doing that for him. I think that they felt I gave him what the send off that he deserved.
Now let's get Ken on the line, and Ken's with us from Fort Myers in Florida.
Hello, Bette.
Hello.
I just wanted to say hello because I haven't talked to you since 1971, when I was a young man. My claim to fame is that I sang with you at the Continental. You were asking for some volunteers from the audience, and we sang Teenager in Love. And after that, I saw you in Buffalo at the Klein Hands Music Hall. And after that, I saw you in Philadelphia in the Clams on the Half Shell Review and in the Detour in Fairmount Park. Then I moved to Florida.
Well, it's nice to hear your voice again. Are you still a teenager in love?
Yes. Yeah.
That's good to hear.
We went down on one knee and sang wop, 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 wop. And you were gorgeous.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
I'm sure she still is.
I hope so.
Ken, thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Ken, of course, is hardly the only person to sing with Bette Midler. In the early 70s, she formed a background group called the Harlettes, and here they are singing the Lullaby of Broadway.
Come on along and listen to the Lullaby of Broadway, the hip hooray and ballyhoo, the Lullaby of Broadway, the rumble of a subway train.
Of course, Bette Midler with the Lullaby of Broadway, with the backup singing group, the Harlettes. The roster of singers in that group, ever-changing. Past Harlettes include Melissa Manchester and Katie Sagal, probably best known as the star of the show Married with Children. And Bette Midler, the people who come to your show, sometimes they're looking at the backup singers, too.
I hope so. I'm not paying them top dollar, so people won't look at them.
You pay them top dollar?
I pay them medium-sized top dollars,
okay.
Like at the bottom end of the top dollar. But they are, I'm always very careful about who I get because they take a lot of the weight off my shoulders, They don't have to just look at me. The audience doesn't have to just look at me. They can look at, there's plenty to look at. And I like to provide that for them because, it's hard to sit there, to pay a ticket price and then sit there and watch just one thing all night long. I like to have a lot of activity on the stage. I like to have surprises. I like to have really good dancing and tremendous costuming and wonderful lights because it's an experience. It's my shows are not just concerts. They're not. I don't take myself as seriously as maybe I ought to, but I'm very, very serious about what I give my audiences. And I think that the theatrical experience can be so fantastic. It really can change your life if you. I mean, because I've seen my life was changed when I saw Janis Joplin. My life was changed when I saw Tina Turner. My life was just, you know, turned upside down by those performers. And I believe, I honestly do believe that people's lives can be transformed by these shows. So I try to give them a lot, you know, so they have something to talk about, something for them to be cheerful about for a couple of weeks.
Let's talk with Michael. Michael with us from Reno in Nevada.
Reno, boy, I got a lot of people going to Reno. How about Vegas? Do I have anybody coming to Vegas?
Welcome to Las Vegas. I was wondering if you could talk about, there's another performer on the strip, the divine Mr. M, Manilow, just down the street from you.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of, I thought it would be interesting if you could talk about your relationship with Barry, since the two of you, really from the Continental Baths to producing albums, and now both of you are the king and queen of Las Vegas. Are you planning on maybe dropping in and saying hello?
Well, you know, I went to see his show a couple of years ago, and it was terrific. And I haven't had the opportunity to see his show since I got there. I got there on the 20th of January, and I never left the building until I got out of the – until my show was over, until my 4 weeks were over. And I think, unfortunately, that's kind of the way it works there. You have to work really, really hard. And, I mean, my day starts as soon as I get out of bed. I wind up on the treadmill, and I, you know, have to answer the mail. And I have to, it's a full 12-hour day. And at the end of 12 hours, all you can do is, you know, have a shot of whiskey and lie down. It's pretty severe. And he, I think, goes home every night. I heard that through the grapevine that he was going home every night. So I hope to catch him while I'm there, and I'm sure he's has every intention of catching me.
Well, congratulations to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Mike. It sounds like you're the hardest working woman in show business.
You know what? I'll tell you something strange. It's the stage is 120 feet long, and you have to run from side to side all night long, and I didn't expect that it was going to be such a workout. And I mean, I have to run in order to keep my voice, and so I do that run. But then once you get on the stage, you're running for 90 minutes as well, and it's really pretty intense. You know, I thought it was going to be. I see a lot of kids out there in Las Vegas, and they take it very casually. But because I'm the kind of person I am, I take it quite seriously. That it has to be as good as it can possibly get. So my kids and I, we work really hard. We rehearse almost every day, and we do the sound check every single day. It's a good 12-hour day, and it's good. It shows. I think the audiences have been so responsive because it's quite slick. I have to say, and I'm very proud of it.
Are you up for this 100 nights a year?
I could do this with my eyes closed. I mean, my shows are usually 2.5 hours long, so for me to do a 90-minute show is like, oh my God, I'm on a holiday! You know, it's like, it's a resort town, and we are doing basically half of what we usually have to do, so for us it's like a thrill, you know, but it still has to be, you know, it has to be really good, it has to be perfect, and it has to be mesmerizing. And so, and in order for it to look easy, you have to work very hard, and that's what we do.
Let's get Robbie on the line. Robbie's with us from Napa in California.
Hi, Bette.
Hi.
Thank you so much for such a wonderful career. You're such a consummate performer. The first time I saw you was in the very early 80s, maybe 80 or 81 in San Francisco at the Warfield, and I thought I was coming to a concert. I didn't realize I was coming to a real show. You're such a hard worker. You put out so much to us. I have so much gratitude to you. And I wanted to just ask you, in those very early days, your shows were different, you know, from your Sophie Tucker jokes, even the taco joke. And then when you went to Disney, things changed. I'm wondering, if, as you're going into Vegas, are you going to bring back some of that spicy show that we used to see a long time ago?
Well, I actually have. I've done that because I found that I think that Vegas was a real opportunity to be pretty raucous. I mean, it's a kind of a – it's a town that needs that, you know. They had their flirtation with family entertainment as well, and they decided they'd go back to being Sin City. And in a funny way, I have decided the same thing. I mean, I'm very good natured, but I work pretty blue, as they used to say in the old days. And I'm actually having a great time. I got all my sequins out. I got all my feathers. My girls are half naked, and I have to say, it is ridiculous, but it's the only place in the country where people do that. So, I mean, it's their history, it's their tradition, and I fell right into it.
Oh, great! I think it's fabulous. I hope you'll bring back Dolores DeLago.
She's definitely there. She's there, and all her friends are there too.
Well, I'll be in Vegas to see you. Congratulations, and I can't wait.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Robbie. We're talking with Bette Midler, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Rosie's with us. Rosie calling from Wisconsin.
Hi, Miss Midler. I just wanted to say, of course, we all know that you are a fabulous woman. Congratulations on your show and all success wish to you. I wanted to also personally thank you for something I don't think people realize on the quieter side of your life. All of the restoration and garden work that you've done in New York City is an astounding thing. And I personally want to say thank you so much for your commitment to that program.
Thank you so much. It's the part of my life. It's the part of my life that I like the best. It's I've had this organization, New York Restoration Project, since 1995, and we've restored a lot of public parks. We have taken ownership of 57 community gardens, which we restore, and we restore three or four of them every single year with the help of a lot of great donors like Home Depot and Toyota and Target. And we are planting 1 million trees. In the next 10 years, our organization, along with a number of other greening organizations in New York City, will be planting 1 million trees in line with Mayor Bloomberg's Plan NYC initiative. And this year we have planted almost 80,000, and we have another 20,000 to go in the fall. So we're doing great. And everyone, the outpouring of support has been sensational. And it's a kind of a legacy, and I'm really I never expected it to become so important to consume so much of my life, but I enjoy it so much, and I enjoy the fact that people enjoy it. I get a lot of support and a lot of gratitude for it.
And you do, and you're an extraordinary, extraordinary person, and I just think it's nice that people know you're a very multifaceted and busy woman to do all those things, and we really appreciate it.
Thanks, Rosie.
Thank you so much.
Let's see if we can go now to Sarah. Sarah calling from Cleveland.
Hello, Ms. Midler.
Hello.
Hi. You know, I was just calling in just mostly out of gratitude for your incredible career. I'm 27 years old, and I don't remember a time in my life without the presence of you.
Oh, that's so nice.
Thank
you.
Your work has definitely transcended generations, and it amazes me how completely poignant and relevant it always is, even down to the commentary made in songs such as Lullaby and Blue, which brings to light the important issues embedded within adoption. You spoke about the understated position of a birth parent, just the comments you've made about how AIDS has decimated the population of your friends. Although you are an amazing performer, your voice is just something that needs to be heard, and I greatly appreciate that. Although you broach very serious topics, you do it in a sensitive way, yet where it's not overdramatic.
Thank you. Thank you. Gee, all this time I thought I was being overly dramatic. But I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks very much for the call, Sarah. Is there something left that you would still like to do?
I think I'd like to finish the 1 million trees. That's a big deal. That's going to be hard. The mayor put aside $400 million. For this initiative over 10 years, and I really would like to see that finished. I think about all sorts of things. You know, I live in New York City. I've lived here on and off since 1965, and I've seen it go through highs and lows, and I've seen, you know, Manhattan is one part of the city that's really, I can't say it's not thriving. I mean, real estate values are extraordinary, and there's a lot of building, and there's a lot of clamor for homes here. But the outer boroughs, sometimes I think they've been neglected. And so I'd like to see the reforestation of New York City. I really would. I think that's something that I've taken on, and that's the main thing that I'd like to see done before I shuffle off this mortal coil.
Can you stay with us for a couple more calls?
Yes.
All right. Bette Midler will stay with us. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. We're also going to be talking about the R. Kelly trial when we come back. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and our guest today is Bette Midler. She's got a new show in Las Vegas at the Coliseum at Caesar's Palace. It's called The Showgirl Must Go On. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And I've read that you've told a quote about your daughter that if you ever enter into show business, I'll never speak to you again. How much of that was a joke, and how much of that did you mean?
Well, I've gotten into hot water about that one. I was very nervous about. I said, if you ever go into show business, I'll kill you.
Ah.
I didn't say I'll.
Well, that's a way of not talking to her again.
Well, you know, I tell you, I think I made a big mistake because that's really her own business. It's up to her what she wants to do. And she said to me, she told me that I had squashed whatever, you know, impulse she had had to be a performer. And I really felt badly about that. And so we talk about it every now and again. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if she did wind up in show business. I guess I wanted to save her the grief, you know. I didn't want her – I love her to death, and I just didn't want her to be in any kind of psychic pain. And it can be very hard. You know, the most marvelous part about it, the glamour of it and the photography, and isn't it great? You get to wear good clothes and sit for 2.5 hours in a makeup chair. Fabulous.
Mm.
That part, the glamorous part, is one thing, but the underbelly of it is quite stressful, and it can be quite unattractive. And I just didn't feel that. I wanted to spare her that. And so I made that comment, and she took it very much to heart. But now we're rethinking.
Even at your level of success.
Because you don't, you know, I didn't want her to be compared to me, and I didn't want her to have to answer questions about me, and I didn't want her to have to, you know, be on a, have a yardstick and constantly be, you know, seeing where she is in comparison to me. I didn't want that for her. I wanted her to be her own person without any effect, without me having any effect on what she was or what she turned out to be. And I don't think it's really possible. I really don't. It's too, the machine is so big, and the machine is very powerful. And the churning of the machine, the beast that has to be fed all the time, it's everywhere, you know. And now with the internet, it's beyond everywhere. It's, you know, it's...
You know, everything,
cosmic.
Nothing dies either.
Nothing dies, and it's there forever. And so I expect that she's going to be answering questions about me until she's, you know, an old lady. And I don't look forward to that for her. So I tried to, you know, I did the wrong thing. I tend to step on my own feet, on my own tongue often. So I apologized, and now we talk about it. We have our little summit conferences over the thing. So
let's speak with Laura. Laura's with us from Kansas City.
Hi, Ms. Midler. Thank you so much for taking my call.
My pleasure.
Thank you. I saw you just a couple of years ago on a talk show, which one I can't remember. And you
me
were
either.
Talking about how the decades were getting better, your 40th birthday, turning 50. And I wondered, is it still getting better?
Well, I am going to call a dog a dog, and I'm going to tell you it is getting really hard. My eyes are gone. My eyes just, sort of disappeared in the last couple of years. So now I have to wear glasses to read, which is my biggest heartbreak because I'm a big reader and I used to get into bed and read, you know, till all hours of the night. And now I can't do that without a pair of glasses. And, you know, I have little twinges here and there. And I kind of do see that it's tough. It's really, you know, I'm out there with all everybody else, but I do try, and I'm a big believer in maintenance, big believer in exercise, big believer. I'm a big believer in Bragg's apple cider vinegar with molasses and with a chaser of fish oil. I'm a big believer in this stuff, and it really has helped a lot. I think you really do have to pay attention. You can't just, you know, drop the ball and say, oh, the hell with it, I give up. You can't really do that. Otherwise, things that you don't want to be visited by will definitely come up and visit you. So I take the activist approach, and it has been good, but I must say I do see certain failings, and it gives one pause.
You say you work a 12-hour day when you're doing the show, and how much time do you exercise in addition?
Well, I'm on the treadmill. I'm on the treadmill for about 45 minutes. I do have to run because that's the only way your lungs stay sort of, you know, flexible. And once that seizes up, it's really hard to sing. It's hard to breathe. It's hard to hold notes. And I dance and sing at the same time, which is really hard. And if I don't do that, I just forget it. I can't do it. I can't do it at all.
And is any problem with the desert air?
Not so far. And you know what's so interesting is that I was in the hotel the whole time. My crew and my girls and everybody, they were out in a place, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, who knows where. And a lot of people got sick, I think because they actually were outside a lot more than I was. And I was in the hotel, and I'm the only one who didn't get sick. So maybe it was the Bragg's vinegar. Who knows?
Who knows? Laura, thanks very much for the call. And Bette Midler, I can't thank you enough for your time today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And good luck with the show.
Thank you. Come on down.
Bette Midler's Five Nights a Week Las Vegas show is called The Showgirl Must Go On. It'll continue through next year at the Coliseum at Caesar's Palace. Her latest CD is Jackpot, The Best of Bette. It's in stores now. She joined us from our bureau in New York. Coming up, we'll talk about the R. Kelly trial.